So drugs, then, you're saying you feel may be a factor? The doctor interrupted. The depressed young woman's face emptied once more. She engaged briefly in something the staffers on specials called the 1,000-meter stare. Not drugs, she said slowly. The doctor smelled shame in the room, sour and uremic. Her face had become distantly pained now. The girl said, stopping. The doctor felt comfortable saying once again that he was not sure he understood what she was trying to share with him. She now went through a series of expressions that made it clinically possible for the doctor to determine whether or not she was entirely sincere. She looked either pained or trying somehow to suppress hilarity. She said, I don't know if you'll believe me. I'm worried you'll think I'm crazy. I have this thing with pot.
Meaning marijuana.
The doctor was oddly sure that Kate Gompert pretended to sniff instead of engaging in a real sniff. Marijuana. Most people think of marijuana as just some minor substance. I know, just like this natural plant that happens to make you feel good the way poison oak makes you itch. And if you say you're in trouble with hope, people will just laugh. Because there's much worse drugs out there. Believe me, I know.
I'm not laughing at you, Catherine, the doctor said, and meant it.
But I love it so much. Sometimes it's like the center of my life. It does something to me. I know, that's not good, and I got told point blank not to smoke on the Parnate because Dr. Garden said no one knew what certain combinations do yet, and it'd be roulette. But after a while, I always think to myself, it's been a while, and things will be different somehow this time if I do, even on the Parnate. So I do again. I start again. I'll start out doing just like a couple of hits off of Dubois after work to get me through dinner, because dinner with my mother and me is, well, but, and then pretty soon after, a while I'm in my room with the fan pointed at the window all night, doing one-hitters and exhaling at the fan to kill the smell. And I make her say I'm not there if anybody calls, and I lie about what I'm doing in there all night, even if she doesn't ask. Sometimes she asks, and sometimes she doesn't. And then after a while I'm smoking joints at work, at breaks, going in the bathroom and standing on the toilet and blowing it out the window. There's this tiny window up high with the glass frosted and all filthy and cobwebby, and I hate having my face up next to it, but if I clean it off, I'm afraid Mrs. Diggs or somebody will be able to tell somebody's been doing something up around the window, standing there in high heels on the rim of the toilet, brushing my teeth all the time, and using up collyrium by the bottleful and switching the console to audio, and always needing more water before I answer the console because my mouth's too dry to talk, especially on the Parnate. The Parnate makes my mouth dry anyways.
30.
And pretty soon, I'm totally paranoid. They know I'm stoned at work, sitting there in the office, high, reeking, and I'm the only one that can't tell I reek. I'm like so obsessed with, do they know? Can they tell? And then after a while, I'm having my mother call in sick for me so I can stay home after she goes in to work and have the whole place to myself with nobody to worry about. Do they know? And smoke out the fan and spray Lysol all over and stir Ginger's little box around so the whole place reeks of ginger and smoke and draw and watch terrible daytime stuff on the TP because I don't want my mother to see any cartridge orders on days I'm supposed to be in bed sick. I start to get obsessed with, does she know? I'm getting more and more miserable and fed up with myself for smoking so much. This is after a couple of weeks of it, is all. And I start getting high and thinking about nothing except how I have to quit smoking all this bob so I can get back to work and start saying I'm here when people call so I can start living some kind of a damn life instead of just sitting around in pajamas pretending I'm sick like a third grader and smoking and watching TP again. And so after I've smoked the last of whatever I've got, I always say, no more, this is it. And I throw out my papers and my one-hitter. I've probably thrown about 50 one-hitters in dumpsters, including some nice wood and brass ones, including a couple from Brazil. The land barge guys must go through our sector's dumpsters once a day, looking to get another good one-hitter. And anyways, I quit. I do stop. I get sick of it. I don't like what it does to me. And I go back to work and work my fanny off to make up for the last couple weeks, and get a leg up on, like, building momentum for a whole new start, you know?
The young woman's face and eyes were going through a number of ranges of affective configurations, with all of them seeming inexplicably at gut level somehow blank and maybe not entirely sincere. "And so," she said, "but then I quit. And a couple of weeks after I've smoked a lot and finally stopped and quit and gone back to really living, after a couple of weeks this feeling always starts creeping in, just creeping in a little at the edges at first. Like first thing in the morning when I get up, or waiting for the tea to go home, after work, for supper. And I try to deny it, the feeling, ignore it, because I fear it more than anything."
"The feeling you're describing that starts creeping in."
Kate Gompert finally took a real breath. "And then, but no matter what I do, it gets worse and worse. It's there more and more. This filter drops down. The feeling makes the fear of the feeling way worse. And after a couple weeks, it's there all the time, the feeling, and I'm totally inside it. I'm in it. And everything has to pass through it to get in. And I don't want to smoke any bob, and I don't want to work, or go out, or read, or watch TP, or go out, or stay in, or either do anything or not do anything. I don't want anything except for the feeling to go away. But it doesn't. Part of the feeling is being, like, willing to do anything to make it go away. Understand that? Anything? Do you understand? It's not wanting to hurt myself. It's wanting to not hurt." The doctor hadn't even pretended to try to take notes on all this. He couldn't keep himself from trying to determine whether the ambient blank insincerity the patient seemed to project during what appeared, clinically, to be a significant gamble, had moved toward trust and self-revealing was, in fact, projected by the patient or was somehow counter-transferred or projected onto the patient from the doctor's own psyche, out of some sort of anxiety over the critical therapeutic possibilities her revelation of concern over drug use might represent. The time this thinking required looked like sober and thoughtful consideration of what Kate Gompert said. She was again gazing at her feet's interactions with the empty boating sneakers, her face moving between expressions associated with grief and suffering. None of the clinical literature the doctor had read for his psych rotation suggested any relation between unipolar episodes and withdrawal from cannabinoids.
"So this has happened in the past, prior to your other hospitalizations then, Catherine?"
Her face, foreshortened by its downward angle, was working in the spread, writhing configurations of weeping, but no tears emerged.
"I just want you to shock me. Just get me out of this. I'll do anything you want."
"Have you explored this possible connection between your cannabis use and your depressions with your regular therapist, Catherine?"
She did not respond directly as such. Her associations began to loosen, in the doctor's opinion, as her face continued to work dryly.
"I had shock before, and it got me out of this. Straps, nurses with their sneakers and little green bags, anti-saliva injections, rubber thing for your tongue, general, just some headaches. I didn't mind it at all. I know everybody thinks it's horrible. That old cartridge, Nichols and the big Indian, distortion. They give you a general here, right? They put you under. It's not that bad. I'll go, willingly."
The doctor was summarizing her choice of treatment option, as was her right, on her chart. He had extremely good penmanship for a doctor. He put her, "get me out of this," in quotation marks. He was adding his own post-assessment question, "then what?" when Kate Gompert began weeping. For real. And just before 0145 hours, on the 2nd of April, YDAU, his wife arrived back home and uncovered her hair and came in and saw the Near Eastern medical attaché and his face and tray and eyes and the soiled condition of his special recliner, and rushed to his side crying his name aloud, touching his head, trying to get a response, failing to get any response to her. He still staring straight ahead. And eventually, and naturally, she, noting that the expression on his rictus of a face nevertheless appeared very positive, ecstatic even, you could say, she, eventually and naturally, turning her head and following his line of sight to the cartridge viewer. Gerhard Stitt, head coach and athletic director at the Enfield Tennis Academy, Enfield, Massachusetts, was wooed fiercely by ETA headmaster Dr. James Incandenza, just about begged to come on board, the moment the Academy's hilltop was shaved flat and the place was up and running. Incandenza had decided he was going to bring Stitt on board or bust. This, even though Stitt had then just lately been asked to resign from the staff of a Nick Bolateri camp in Sarasota because of a really unfortunate incident involving a riding crop. By now, though, pretty much everyone now at ETA feels as though stories about Stitt's whole corporal punitive thing must have been pumped up out of all sane proportion, because even though Stitt still does favor those high and shiny black boots, and yes, the epaulettes, still, and now a weatherman's telescoping pointer that's a clear stand-in for the now-forbidden old riding crop, he has, Stitt, at near what must be 70, mellowed to the sort of elder statesman point where he's become mostly a dispenser of abstractions rather than discipline. A philosopher instead of a king. His felt presence is here mostly verbal. The weatherman's pointer has not made corrective contact with even one athletic bottom in Stitt's whole 9 years at ETA. Still, although he now has all these Lebengefahrtens and pro-rectors to administer most of the necessary little character-building cruelties, Stitt does like his occasional bit of fun still.
31.
So, but when Stitt dons the leather helmet and goggles and revs up the old FRG-era BMW cycle and trails the sweating ETA squads up the Commonwealth Avenue hills into East Newton on their PM conditioning runs, making judicious use of his pea-shooter to discourage straggling sluggards, it's usually 18-year-old Mario Incandenza who gets to ride along in the sidecar, carefully braced and strapped, the wind blowing his thin hair straight back off his oversized head, beaming and waving his claw at people he knows. It's possibly odd that the leptosomatic Mario I, so damaged he can't even grip a stick, much less flail at a moving ball with one, is the one kid at ETA whose company Stitt seeks out, is in fact pretty much the one person with whom Stitt speaks candidly, lets his pedagogical hair down. He's not close to his pro-rectors, particularly, Stitt, and treats Aubrey DeLint and Mary Esther Thode with a formality that's almost parodic. But often of a warm evening, sometimes Mario and Coach Stitt will find themselves out alone under the East Court's canvas pavilion or the towering copper beach west of Com Ad, or at one of the initial scarred redwood picnic tables off the path out behind the headmaster's house, where Mario's mother and uncle live. Stitt savoring a postprandial pipe, Mario enjoying the smells of the calliopsis alongside the ground's quincunx paths, the Swedish pines, and the briar's yeasty musk coming up from the hillside slopes. And he actually likes the sulfury odor of Stitt's obscure Austrian blend. Stitt talks. Mario listens, generally. Mario is basically a born listener. One of the positives to being visibly damaged is that people can sometimes forget you're there, even when they're interfacing with you. You almost get to eavesdrop. It's almost like they're like, if nobody's really in there, there's nothing to be shy about. That's why bullshit often tends to drop away around damaged listeners. Deep beliefs revealed. Diary-type private reveries indulged out loud. And, listening, the beaming and Brady kinetic boy gets to forge an interpersonal connection he knows only he can truly feel here. Stitt has the sort of creepy wiriness of old men who still exercise vigorously. He has surprised blue eyes and a vivid white crew cut of the sort that looks virile and good on men who have lost a lot of hair anyway. and skin so clean, sheet white it almost glows, an evident immunity to the sun's UV. In pine-shaded twilight he is almost glowingly white, as if cut from the stuff of moons. He has a way of focusing his whole self's concentration very narrowly, adjusting his legs spread for the varicoceles, and curling one arm over the other, and sort of drawing himself in around the pipe he attends to. Mario can sit motionless for really long periods. When Stitt exhales pipe smoke in different geometric shapes, they both seem to study intently. When Stitt exhales, he makes little sounds variant in plosivity between P and B.
I'm realizing whole myths of efficiency and no waste that is making this continent of countries we are in.
He exhales.
You know, myths?
Is that like a story?
Ach, a made-up story. For some children. An efficiency of Euclid only. Flat. For flat children. Straight ahead, flower head, go! This is myth.
There aren't any flat children, really.
This myth of the competition and the bestness we fight for you players here. This myth. They assume here always the efficient way is to plow in straight. Go. The story that the shortest way between two places is the straight line, yes?
Yes? Stitt can use the stem of the pipe to point for emphasis.
But what then? When something is in the way. When you go between places, no? Plow ahead, go, collide, kaboom!
Willikers!
There is their straight shortest den, yes? There is the efficiently quickly straight of Euclid den, yes? And how many two places are there without there is something in the way between them if you go?
It can be entertaining to watch the evening pines mosquitoes light and feed deeply on luminous Stitt, who is oblivious. The smoke doesn't keep them away.
When I am boyish, training to compete for best, our training facilities on a sign very largely painted stated, we are what we walk between.
Gosh. It's a tradition, one stemming maybe from Wimbledon's All England Locker Rooms Timpana, that every big-time tennis academy has its own special traditional motto on the wall in the locker rooms, some special aphoristic nugget that's supposed to describe and inform what the academy's philosophy is all about. After Mario's father, Dr. Incandenza, passed away, the new headmaster, Dr. Charles Tavis, a Canadian citizen, either Mrs. Incandenza's half-brother or adoptive brother, depending on the version, C.T., had taken down Incandenza's founding motto, Te occidere possunt, sed te edere non possunt, nefas est. And had replaced it with the rather more upbeat, the man who knows his limitations has none.
32.
Mario is an enormous fan of Gerhard Stitt, whom most of the other ETA kids regard as probably bats, and as, without doubt, mind-looseningly discursive. And show the old pundit even token respect, mostly because Stitt still personally oversees the daily drill assignments, and can, if aggrieved, have Thode and DeLint make them extremely uncomfortable, more or less at will, out there in AM practice. One of the reasons the late James Incandenza had been so terribly high on bringing Stitt to ETA was that Stitt, like the founder himself, who'd come back to tennis, and later film, from a background in hardcore, math-based optical science, was that Stitt approached competitive tennis more like a pure mathematician than a technician. Most junior tennis coaches are basically technicians, hands-on, practical, straight-ahead, problem-solving, statistical data wonks, with maybe added knacks for short-haul psychology and motivational speaking. The point about not crunching serious stats is that Stitt had clued Incandenza in all the way back at a B.S. 1989 USTA convention on photoelectric line judging, that he, Stitt, knew real tennis was really about not the blend of statistical order and expansive potential that the game's technicians revered, but in fact the opposite. Not order. Limit. The places where things broke down, fragmented into beauty.
33.
That real tennis was no more reducible to delimited factors or probability curves than chess or boxing, the two games of which it's a hybrid. In short, Stitt and the tall AEC optics man, i.e., Incandenza, whose fierce, flat, serve and haul ass to the net approach to the game had carried him through MIT on a full ride with stipend, and whose consulting report on high-speed photoelectric tracking the USTA mucky-mucks found dense past all comprehending, found themselves totally simpatico on tennis's exemption from stats tracking regression. Were he now still among the living, Dr. Incandenza would now describe tennis in the paradoxical terms of what's now called extra-linear dynamics.
34.
And Stitt, whose knowledge of formal math is probably about equivalent to that of a Taiwanese kindergartner, nevertheless seemed to know what Hopman and Vandermeer and Volterra seemed not to know. That locating beauty and art and magic and improvement and keys to excellence and victory in the prolix flux of match play is not a fractal matter of reducing chaos to pattern. Seemed intuitively to sense that it was a matter not of reduction at all, but, perversely, of expansion. The aleatory flutter of uncontrolled, metastatic growth. Each well-shot ball admitting of N possible responses, N to the second power possible responses to those responses, and on into what Incandenza would articulate to anyone who shared both his backgrounds as a Cantorian continuum of infinities of possible move and response. Cantorian and beautiful because infoliating contained this diagonal infinity of infinities of choice and execution, mathematically uncontrolled but humanly contained, bounded by the talent and imagination of self and opponent, bent in on itself by the containing boundaries of skill and imagination that brought one player finally down, that kept both from winning, that made it finally a game, these boundaries of self.
35.
You mean like the baselines are boundaries? Mario tries to ask.
Lieber Gott, nein!
With a plosive, disgusted sound. Stitt likes best of all smoke shapes to try to blow rings, and is kind of lousy at it, blowing mostly wobbly lavender hot dogs, which Mario finds delightful. The thing with Stitt, like most Europeans of his generation, anchored from infancy to certain permanent values which, yes, okay, granted, may admittedly have a whiff of proto-fascist potential about them, but which do, nevertheless, the values, anchor nicely the soul and course of a life. Old world, patriarchal stuff like honor and discipline and fidelity to some larger unit, Gerhard Stitt does not so much dislike the modern O-N-A-N-ite U.S. of A. as find it hilarious and frightening at the same time. Probably, mostly just alien. This should not be rendered in exposition like this, but Mario Incandenza has a severely limited range of verbatim recall. Stitt was educated in pre-unification gymnasium, under the rather Canto-Hegelian idea that junior athletics was basically just training for citizenship, that junior athletics was about learning to sacrifice the hot, narrow imperatives of the self, the needs, the desires, the fears, the multiform cravings of the individual appetitive will, to the larger imperatives of a team. Okay, the state. And a set of delimiting rules. Okay, the law. It sounds almost frighteningly simple-minded, though not to Mario, across the redwood table, listening. By learning, in Palestra, the virtues that pay off directly in competitive games, the well-disciplined boy begins assembling the more abstract, gratification-delaying skills necessary for being a team player in a larger arena, the even more subtly diffracted moral chaos of full-service citizenship in a state. Except Stitt says, ach, but who can imagine this training serving its purpose in an experialist, and waste-exporting nation that's forgotten privation and hardship and the discipline which hardship teaches by requiring. A U.S. of modern A, where the state is not a team or a code, but a sort of sloppy intersection of desires and fears, where the only public consensus a boy must surrender to is the acknowledged primacy of straight line pursuing this flat and short-sighted idea of personal happiness.
The happy pleasure of the person alone, yes?
Except why do you let DeLint tie Pemulus and Shaw's shoes to the lines, if the lines aren't boundaries?
Without there is something bigger. Nothing to contain, and give the meaning. Lonely. Verstiegenheit.
36.
Bless you.
Any something. The what? This is more unimportant than that there is something.
Schnitt one time was telling Mario, as they respectively walked and tottered down Commonwealth Avenue eastward into Alston to see about getting a gourmet ice cream someplace along there, that when he was Mario's age, or maybe more like Hal's age, whatever, he, Schnitt, had once fallen in love with a tree. A willow that, from a certain humid twilight perspective, had looked like a mysterious woman aswirl with gauze. This certain tree, in the public plots of some West German town whose name sounded to Mario like the sound of somebody strangling. Schnitt reported being seriously smitten with the tree.
I went daily to there, to be with the tree.
They respectively walked and tottered, ice cream bound. Mario moving like the one of them who was truly old, mind off his stride because he was trying to think hard about what Schnitt believed. Mario's thinking hard expression resembles what, for another person, would be the sort of comically distorted face made to amuse an infant. He was trying to think how to articulate some reasonable form of a question like, but then how does this surrender the personal, individual wants to the larger state or beloved tree or something stuff work, in a deliberately individual sport like competitive junior tennis, where it's just you versus one other guy? And then also, again, still, what are those boundaries, if they're not baselines, that contain and direct its infinite expansion inward, that make tennis like chess on the run, beautiful and infinitely dense? Schnitt's thrust, and his one great irresistible attraction in the eyes of Mario's late father, the true opponent, the enfolding boundary, is the player himself. Always and only the self out there, on court, to be met, fought, brought to the table to hammer out terms. The competing boy on the net's other side, he is not the foe. He is more the partner in the dance. He is the, what is the word, excuse or occasion for meeting the self, as you are his occasion. Tennis's beauty's infinite roots are self-competitive. You compete with your own limits to transcend the self in imagination and execution. Disappear inside the game. Break through limits. Transcend. Improve. Win. Which is why tennis is an essentially tragic enterprise, to improve and grow as a serious junior with ambitions. You seek to vanquish and transcend the limited self whose limits make the game possible in the first place. It is tragic and sad and chaotic and lovely. All life is the same, as citizens of the human state. The animating limits are within, to be killed and mourned over and over again. Mario thinks of a steel pole, raised to double its designed height, and clips his shoulder on the green steel edge of a dumpster, pirouetting halfway to the cement before Schnitt darts in to catch him. And it almost looks like they're doing a dance floor dip, as Schnitt says this game the players are all at ETA to learn, this infinite system of decisions and angles and lines Mario's brothers worked so brutishly hard to master. Junior athletics is but one facet of the real gem. Life's endless war against the self you cannot live without. Schnitt then falls into the sort of silence of someone who's enjoying mentally rewinding and replaying what he just came up with. Mario thinks hard again. He's trying to think of how to articulate something like, but then is battling and vanquishing the self the same as destroying yourself? Is that like saying life is pro-death? Three passing Alstonian street kids mock and make fun of Mario's appearance behind the pair's backs. Some of Mario's thinking faces are almost orgasmic, fluttery, and slack. And then, but so, what's the difference between tennis and suicide, life and death, the game and its own end? It's always Shtit who ends up experimenting with some exotic ice cream flavor when they arrive. Mario always chickens out and opts for good old basic chocolate when the moment of decision at the counter comes. Thinking along the lines of, like, better the flavor you know for sure you already love.
And so, no different, maybe, Shtit concedes.
Sitting up straight on a waffle-seated aluminum chair, with Mario beneath an askew umbrella that makes the flimsy little table it's rooted to shake and clank in the sidewalk's breeze.
Maybe no different, though.
Biting hard into his tricolored cone. He feels at the side of his white jaw where there's some sort of red welt, it looks like.
Not different.
Looking out into the avenue's raised median at the Green Line train rattling past downhill.
Except the chance to play.
He brightens in preparation to laugh in his startling German roar, saying,
no? Yes? The chance to play. Yes?
And Mario loses a dollop of chocolate down his chin because he has this involuntary thing where he laughs whenever anyone else does, and Shtit is finding what he has just said very amusing indeed. Year of the Depend, Adult Undergarment. There is no jolly irony in Tiny Ewell's name. He is tiny, an elf-sized U.S. male. His feet barely reach the floor of the taxi. He is seated, being driven east into the grim three-decker districts of East Watertown, west of Boston proper. A rehabilitative staffer wearing custodial whites under a bombardier's jacket sits beside Tiny Ewell, big arms crossed and staring placid as a cow at the intricately creased back of the cabbie's neck. The window Tiny is next to has a sticker that thanks him in advance for not smoking. Tiny Ewell wears no winter gear over a jacket and tie that don't quite go together and stares out his window with unplacid intensity at the same district he grew up in. He normally takes involved routes to avoid Watertown. His jacket, a 26 small. His slacks, a 26-24. His shirt, one of the shirts his wife had so considerately packed for him to bring into the hospital detox and hang on hangers that won't leave the rod. As with all Tiny Ewell's business shirts, only the front and cuffs are ironed. He wears size 6 Florsheim wingtips that gleam nicely except for one big, incongruous scuff mark of white from where he'd kicked at his front door when he'd returned home just before dawn from an extremely important get-together with potential clients, to find that his wife had had the locks changed and filed a restraining order, and would communicate with him only by notes passed through the mail slot below the white door's black brass. The brass had been painted black. Knocker. When Tiny leans down and wipes at the scuff mark with a slim thumb, it only pales and smears. It is Tiny's first time out of happy slippers since his second day at the detox. They took away his Florsheims after 24 abstinent hours had passed, and he started to perhaps DT a little. He'd kept noticing mice scurrying around his room. Mice as in rodents, vermin. And when he lodged a complaint and demanded the room be fumigated at once, and then began running around, hunched and pounding with the heel of a handheld Florsheim at the mice, as they continued to ooze through the room's electrical outlets and scurry repulsively about, eventually a gentle-faced nurse, flanked by large men in custodial whites, negotiated a trade of shoes for Librium, predicting that the mild sedative would fumigate what really needed to be fumigated. They gave him slippers of green, foam rubber with smiley faces embossed on the tops. The detox's inpatients are encouraged to call these happy slippers. The staff referred to the footwear in private as piss catchers. It is Tiny Ewell's first day out of rubber slippers and ass-exposing detox pajamas and striped cotton robe in 2 weeks. The early November day is foggy and colorless. The sky and the street are the same color. The trees look skeletal. There is bright, wet, wadded litter all along the seams of street and curb. The houses are skinny three-deckers, mashed together, wharf gray, with salt-white trim. Madonnas in the yards, bow-legged dogs hurling themselves against the fencing. Some schoolboys in knee pads and scally caps are playing street hockey on a passing school cement playground, except none of the boys seems to be moving. The trees' bony fingers make spell-casting gestures in the wind as they pass. East Watertown is the obvious straight-line easement between St. Mel's Detox and the halfway house's Enfield, and Ewell's insurance is paying for the cab. With his small round shape and bit of white goatee, and a violent flush that could pass for health of some jolly sort, Tiny Ewell looks like a radically downscaled Burl Ives. The late Burl Ives, as an impossible, bearded child. Tiny looks out the window at the rose window of the church next to the school playground, where the boys are playing slash not playing. The rose window is not illuminated from either side. The man who, for the last 3 days, has been Tiny Ewell's roommate at St. Mel's Hospital's detoxification unit, sits in a blue plastic straight-back chair in front of his and Ewell's room's Windows air conditioner, watching it. The air conditioner hums and gushes, and the man gazes with rapt intensity into its screen of horizontal vents. The air conditioner's cord is thick and white, and leads into a three-prong outlet with black heel marks on the wall all around it. The November room is around 12 degrees centigrade. The man turns the air conditioner's dial from setting number 4 to setting number 5. The curtains above it shake and billow around the window. The man's face falls into and out of amused expressions as he watches the air conditioner. He sits in the blue chair with a trembling styrofoam cup of coffee and a paper plate of brownies into which he taps ashes from the cigarettes whose smoke the air conditioner blows straight back over his head. The cigarette smoke is starting to pile up against the wall behind him, and to ooze and run, chilled, down the wall, and form a sort of cloud bank near the floor. The man's raptly amused profile appears in the mirror on the wall beside the dresser the two inpatients share. The man, like Tiny Ewell, has the rouged corpse look that attends detox from late-stage alcoholism. The man is, in addition, a burnt yellow beneath his flush from chronic hepatitis. The mirror he appears in is treated with shatterproof lucite polymers. The man leans carefully forward with the plate of brownies in his lap and changes the setting on the air conditioner from 5 to 3, and then to 7. Then 8, scanning the screen of gushing vents. He finally turns the selector's dial all the way around to 9. The air conditioner roars and blows his long hair straight back, and his beard blows back over his shoulder. Ashes fly and swirl around from his plate of brownies, plus crumbs, and his Rodney's tip glows cherry and gives sparks. He is deeply engaged by whatever he sees on 9. He gives Tiny Ewell the screaming memes, Ewell has complained. He wears piss catchers, a striped cotton St. Mel's robe, and a pair of glasses missing one lens. He has been watching the air conditioner all day. His face produces the little smiles and grimaces of a person who's being thoroughly entertained. When the big black rehabilitative staffer placed Tiny Ewell in the taxi and then squeezed in and told the cabbie they wanted unit number 6 in the Enfield Marine VA hospital complex just off Commonwealth Avenue in Enfield, the cabbie, whose photo was on the Massachusetts livery license taped to the glove compartment, the cabbie looking back and down at little Tiny Ewell's neat white beard and ruddy complexion and sharp threads, had scratched under his scally cap and asked if he was sick or something. Tiny Yule had said, "So it would seem." By mid-afternoon on the 2nd of April, YDAU, the Near Eastern medical attaché, his devout wife, the Saudi Prince Q's personal physician's personal assistant, who'd been sent over to see why the medical attaché hadn't appeared at the Back Bay Hilton in the AM, and then hadn't answered his beeper's page. The personal physician himself, who'd come to see why his personal assistant hadn't come back. Two embassy security guards with sidearms, who'd been dispatched by a candidiatic, heartily pissed off Prince Q, and two neatly groomed Seventh-day Adventist pamphleteers who'd seen human heads through the living room window and found the front door unlocked and come in with all good spiritual intentions. All were watching the recursive loop the medical attaché had rigged on the TP's viewer the night before, sitting and standing there very still and attentive, looking not one bit distressed or in any way displeased, even though the room smelled very bad. Indeed. The 30th of April, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. He sat alone above the desert, redly backlit and framed in shale, watching very yellow payloaders crawl over the beaten dirt of some USA construction site, several kilometers to the southeast. The outcropping's height allowed him, Marat, to look out over most of USA, area code 6026. His shadow did not yet reach the downtown regions of the city of Tucson. Not yet quite. Of sounds in the air at hush were only a faint and occasional hot wind, the blurred sound of the wings of sometimes an insect, some tentative trickling of loosened grit and small stones moving farther down the upslope behind, and as well the sunset over the foothills and mountains behind him. Such a difference from the watery and somehow sad spring sunsets of southwestern Quebec's Papineau regions, where his wife had need of care. This, the sunset, more resembled an explosion. It took place above and behind him, and he turned some of the time to regard it. It, the sunset, was swollen and perfectly round and large, radiating knives of light when he squinted. It hung and trembled slightly, like a viscous drop about to fall. It hung just above the peaks of the Tortolita foothills behind him, Marat, and slowly was sinking. Marat sat alone and blanket-lapped in his customized fauteuil de Roland, on a kind of outcropping or shelf about halfway up, waiting, amusing himself with his shadow.
37.
As the lowering light from behind came at an angle more and more acute, Goethe's well-known Brockengespenst phenomenon enlarged and distended his seated shadow far out over land, so that the spokes of his chair's rear wheels cast over two whole counties below gigantic asterisk shadows, whose fine black radial lines he could cause to move by playing slightly with the wheel's rubber rims. And his head's shadow brought to much of the suburb West Tucson a premature dusk.
38.
He appeared to remain concentrated on his huge shadow play as gravel, and then also breath, sounded from the steep hillside back above him, grit and dirty stones cascading onto the outcropping and gushing past his chair and off the front lip, and then the unmistakable yelp of an individual's impact with a cactus somewhere up behind. But Marat, he had all the time without turning watched the other man's clumsy sliding descent's own mammoth shadow, cast as far east as the Rincon Range, just past the city Tucson, I could see the shadow rush in west toward his own, as Unspecified Services M. Hugh Steeply descended, falling twice and cursing in USA English, until the shadow collapsed nearly into Marat's monstrous own. Another yelp took place as the Unspecified Services field operatives fall and slide, the last several meters carried him up on his bottom, down onto the outcropping, and then nearly all the way out and off it, Marat having to release the machine pistol under his blanket to grab Steeply's bare arm and halt this sliding. Steeply's skirt was pulled obscenely up and his hosiery full of runs and stubs of thorns. The operative sat at Murat's feet, glowing redly in the backlight, legs hanging over the shelf's edge, breathing with difficulty. Murat smiled and released the operative's arm.
"Stealth becomes you," he said.
"Go shit in your chapeau,"
Steeply wheezed, bringing up his legs to survey the hosiery's damage. They spoke, for the most part, USA English when they met like this, covertly in the field. Monsieur Fautier had wished Murat to require that they interface always in Quebecois French, as for a small symbolic concession to the AFR on the part of the Office of Unspecified Services, which the Quebecois separatist left referred to always as BSS, the Bureau des Services sans spécificité.
39.
Murat watched a column of shadow spread again out east over the desert's floor as Steeply got a hand under himself and rose, a huge and well-fed figure, tottering on heels. The two men sent together a strange, brockengespenst shadow out toward the city Tucson, a shadow round and radial at the base and jagged at the top, from Steeply's wig becoming uncombed in his descent. Steeply's gigantic prosthetic breasts pointed in wildly different directions now, one nearly at the empty sky. The mat curtain of sunset's true dusk shadow was moving itself very slowly in across the Rincons and Sonora Desert east of the city Tucson, still many kilometers from obscuring their own large shadow. But once Murat had committed not just to pretend to betray his encensant de fauteuil roulant, in order to secure advanced medical care for the medical needs of his wife, but to, in truth, do this, betray, perfidiously, now pretending only to Monsieur Fautier and his AFR superiors that he was merely pretending to feed some betraying information to BSS. Once this decision, Murat was without all power, served now at the pleasures of the power of Steeply and the BSS of Hugh Steeply. And now they spoke mostly the USA English of Steeply's preference.
40.
In fact, Steeply's Quebecois was better than Murat's English. But c'était la guerre, as one says. Murat sniffed slightly.
That's so. We now are both here.
He wore a windbreaker and did not perspire. Steeply's eyes were luridly made up. The rear area of his dress was dirty. Some of his makeup had started to run. He was forming a type of salute to shade his eyes and looking upward behind them at what remained of the explosive and trembling sun.
How in God's name did you get up here?
Murat slowly shrugged. As usual, he appeared to Steeply as if he were half asleep. He ignored the question and said only, shrugging,
My time is finite.
Steeply had also with him a woman's handbag or purse.
And the wife? He said, gazing upward as yet. How's the wife doing?
Holding her own weight, thank you,
Murat said. His tone of his voice betrayed nothing.
And so thus, what is it your officers believe they wish to know?
Steeply tottered on a leg as he removed one shoe and poured from it grit.
Nothing terribly surprising. A bit of razzle-dazzle up northeast in your so-called ops area, certainly you heard.
Murat sniffed. A large odor of inexpensive and high-alcohol perfume came not from Steeply's person, but from his handbag, which failed to complement his shoes. Murat said,
Dazel?
As in a civilian-type individual receives a certain item? Don't tell me this is news to you guys. Not on interlaced pulse, this item. Arrives via normal physical mail. We're sure you heard, Raimi. A cartridge copy of a certain, let's call it, between ourselves, the entertainment? As in the mail, without warning or motive, out of the blue?
From somewhere blue?
The BSS operative had perspired also through his rouge, and his mascara had melted to become whorish.
A person with no political value to anybody except that the Saudi Ministry of Entertainment made one hell of a shrill stink.
The medical attaché, the specialist of digesting you refer to,
Marat shrugged again, in that maddening francophone way that can mean several things.
Your officers wish to ask, was the entertainment cartridge disseminated through our mechanisms?
Don't let's waste your finite time, Ami, old friend, Steeply said. The mischief happens to occur in metropolitan Boston. Postal codes route the package through the desert southwest, and we know your dissemination scheme's routing mechanism is proposed for somewhere between Phoenix and the border down here.
Steeply had worked hard at feminizing his expressions and gesturing.
It will be a bit starry-eyed of O.U.S. not to think of your distinguished cell, no?
Beneath Marat's windbreaker was a sport shirt whose breast pocket was filled with many pins. He said,
Us, we don't have the information on even casualties. From this blue dazzle you speak of.
Steeply was trying to extract something stubborn from inside his other shoe.
Upwards of 20, Raimi. Out of commission, altogether. The attaché and his wife. The wife, a Saudi citizen. 4 more raggers, all with embassy cards. Couple neighbors or something. The rest mostly police before word got to a level they could stop police from going in before they killed the power.
Local police forces? Or gendarme?
The local constabulary.
The minions of the law of the land.
The local constabulary were, shall we say, unprepared for an entertainment like this.
Steeply even removed and replaced his pumps in the upright, on one leg bringing other foot up behind his bottom way of a feminine USA woman. But he appeared huge and bloated as a woman. Not merely unattractive, but inducing something like sexual despair, he said,
The attaché had diplomatic status, Raimi. Mideast, Saudi. Said to be close to minor members of the royal family.
Marat sniffed hard, as if congested of the nose.
A puzzling, he said.
But also a compatriot of yours. Canadian citizenship. Born in Ottawa. To Arab emigres. Visa lists a residence in Montreal.
On services without specificity, wishes maybe to ask, were there below-the-surface connections that make the individual not such a civilian? Unconnected? To ask of us, would the AFR wish to make of him the example?
Steeply was removing dirt from his bottom, swatting himself on the bottom. He stood more or less directly over Marat. Marat sniffed.
We have neither digestive medicals, nor diplomatic entourages on any list for action. You have personally seen AFR's initial lists, nor in particular Montreal civilians. We have, as one will say, a largeur of seafood to cook.
Steeply was looking out over the desert and city also, as he swatted at himself. He seemed to have noticed the gespenst phenomenon of his own shadow. Marat, for some reason, pretended again to sniff the nose. The wind was moderate and constant, and of about the temperature of a USA clothes dryer set on low. It made the shrill whistling sounds. Also sounds of the blowing grit. Weeds of tumbling, like enormous hairballs, rolled often across the interstate highway of I-10 far below. Their specular perspective, the reddening light on vast tan stone, and the oncoming curtain of dusk, the further elongation of their monstrous agate shadows, all was almost mesmerizing. Neither man seemed able to look at anything but the vista below. Marat could simultaneously speak in English and think in French. The desert was the tawny color of the hide of the lion. They're speaking without looking at one another, facing both the same direction. This gave their conversing an air of careless intimacy, as of old friends at the cartridge viewer together, or a long-married couple. Marat thought this as he opened and closed his upheld hand, making over the city Tucson a huge and black blossom open itself and close itself. And Steeply raised his bare arms and held them out and crossed them, maybe as if signaling for distant aid. This made X's and pedantic V's over much of the city Tucson.
Still, Raimi, but born in the hated-by-you Ottawa, this civilian attaché, and connected to a major buyer of Transgrid Entertainment, and follow up out of the Boston office's reports possible indications of the victim's prior possible involvement with the widow of the auteur we both know was responsible for the entertainment in the first place.
The samizdat.
Prior? Steeply produced from his handbag, Belgian cigarettes, of a many-millimeter and habitually female type.
Film director's wife had taught out at Brandeis where the victim had done his residency. The husband was on board over at AEC. The different agency's background checks indicated the wife was fucking just about everything with a pulse.
With a slight pause of which Steeply could excel, particularly a Canadian pulse.
Involvement of sexuality is what you are meaning, then, not politics?
Steeply said, this wife herself a Quebecer, Ramey, from Lillet County. Chief Tyne says 3 years spent on Ottawa's personne qui en droit list. There's such a thing as political sex.
I have said to you all we know. Civilians, as individual warnings to ONAN, are not our desire. This is known by you.
Marat's eyes looked nearly closed.
And your teats. They have become cockeyed, I will tell you. Services without specificity, they have given you ridiculous teats. And now they point differently.
Steeply looked down at himself. One of the false breasts, surely false. Surely they would not go as far as the hormonal, Marat thought. Nearly touched the chins of Steeply, when his looking down produced his double chins.
I was asked to secure personal verification is all, he said. My general sense at the office is the brass consider the whole incident a stumper. There are theories and counter-theories. There are even anti-theories, positing error, mistaken identity, sick hoax.
His shrugging with his hands on the prosthesis appeared not at all Gallic.
Still, 23 human beings lost for all time.
That'd be some hoax, no?
Marat sniffed.
Asked to verify by our mutual Monsieur Tyne? How you call him, Rod a God?
Rodney Tyne Sr., Chief of Unspecified Services, acknowledged architect of ONAN and Continental Reconfiguration, who held the ear of the White House of USA,
and whose stenographer had long doubled as the stenographer come jeune fille de vendredi
of Monsieur Duplessis, former assistant coordinator of the Pan-Canadian Resistance, and whose passionate, ill-disguised attachment, Tynes, to this double amanuensis, one Mademoiselle Luria Perec of Lambertine, County Lillet, Quebec, gave rise to these questions of the high-level loyalties of Tyne. Whether he doubled for Quebec out of the love for Luria, or tripled the loyalties, pretending only to divulge secrets, while secretly maintaining his USA fealty against the pull of an irresistible love, it was said.
41.
The Ramey. It was clear that Steeply could not fix his breasts' directions without pulling down severely his décolletage, which he was shy to do.
He produced from his handbag sunglasses and put on the sunglasses. They were embellished with rhinestones and looked absurd.
Rod the God.
Marat forced himself to say nothing of their appearance. Steeply tried with several matches to light a cigarette in the wind. The encroachment of true dusk began to erase his wig's chaotic shadow. Electric lights began to twinkle in the Rincon foothills east of the city. Steeply tried somewhat to cup his body around the match, for shelter for the flame. It's a herd of feral hamsters, a major herd, thundering across the yellow plains of the southern reaches of the Great Concavity in what used to be Vermont, raising dust that forms a uremic-hued cloud, with somatic shapes interpretable from as far away as Boston and Montreal. The herd is descended from two domestic hamsters set free by a Watertown, New York boy at the beginning of the experialist migration in the subsidized Year of the Whopper. The boy now attends college in Champaign, Illinois. and has forgotten that his hamsters were named Ward and June. The noise of the herd is tornadic, locomotival. The expression on the hamsters' whiskered faces is businesslike and implacable. It's that implacable herd expression. They thunder eastward across pedulphorous terrain that today is fallow, denuded. To the east, dimmed by the fulvous cloud the hamsters send up, is the vivid, verdant, ragged outline of the annularly over-fertilized forests of what used to be central Maine. All these territories are now property of Canada. With respect to a herd of this size, please exercise the sort of common sense that, come to think of it, would keep your thinking man out of the southwest concavity anyway. Feral hamsters are not pets. They mean business. Wide berth advised. Carry nothing even remotely vegetable-ish if in the path of a feral herd. If in the path of such a herd, move quickly and calmly in a direction perpendicular to their own. If American, north, not advisable. Move south, calmly, and in all haste, toward some border metropolis. Rome, New New York, or Glen Falls, New New York, or Beverly, Massachusetts, say, or those bordered points between them, at which the giant protective ATHSCME fans atop the hugely convex protective walls of anodized lucite hold off the drooling and piss-colored bank of teratogenic concavity clouds and move the bank well back, north, away, jaggedly, over your protected head. The heavily-tongued English of Steepley was even more difficult to understand with a cigarette in his mouth. He said,
"And of course you'll port this little interface of you and me right back to 48?
Marat shrugged.
"Bien sûr."
Steepley got it lit. He was a large and soft man, some type of brutal U.S. contact sport athlete now become fat. He appeared to Marat to look less like a woman than a twisted parody of womanhood. Electrolysis had caused patches of tiny red pimples along his jowls and upper lip. He also held his elbow out, the arm holding the match for lighting, which is how no woman lights a cigarette. It was used to breasts and keeps the lighting elbow in. Also, Steepley teetered ungracefully on his pump's heels on the stone's uneven surface. He never for a moment turned his back completely at Marat as he stood on the lip of the outcropping. And Marat had his chair's wheels, clamps, now locked down tight, and a firm grip on the machine pistol's pebbled grip. Steepley's purse was small and glossy black, and the sunglasses he wore had womanly frames with small false jewels at the temples. Marat believed that something in Steepley enjoyed his grotesque appearance, and craved the humiliation of the field disguises his BSS superiors requested of him. Steepley now looked at him, improbability behind the dark glasses.
"And also that I just right now asked you if you'd report it, and that you said, 'Bien sir'?"
Marat's laugh had this misfortune to sound false and overhearty, whether or not sincere. He made a mustache of his finger, pretending for some reason to stifle a need to sneeze.
"You verify this because of why?"
Steepley scratched under the hem of his blonde wig, with, stupidly, dangerously, the thumb of his hand that held the cigarette.
"Well, you are already tripling, Ramey, aren't you? Or would it be quadrupling? We know 40A and the AFR know you're here with me now.
But do my brothers on wheels know that you are knowing this? That they have sent me to pretend a devil?"
Marat's sidearm, a sterling UL-35 9mm machine pistol with a Magnaport silencer, did not have a safety. Its fat and texture of pebbles grip was hot from Marat's palm, and in turn caused Marat's palm to perspire beneath the blanket. From Steepley there merely was silence. Marat said,
"Have I merely pretended to pretend to pretend to betray?"
42.
And the desert USA's light had become now sad, more than half the round sun gone behind the tortellitas. Only now the chair's wheels and Steepley's thick legs cast shadows below the desk line. and these shadows were becoming squat and retreating back up toward the two men. Steeply did a brief pretend Charleston, playing with his legs' shadows.
Nothing personal, you know that. It's the obsessive caution. Who was it? Who once said, we get paid to drive ourselves crazy? The caution thing. You guys, and Tyne. Your Diplocile was suspected he tried to hold back on the information he passed sexually to Luria.
Morant shrugged hard.
And abruptly, Monsieur Duplessis has now passed away from life. Under circumstances of almost ridiculous suspicion.
Again with the false-sounding laugh.
An inept burglary. And grief, indeed.
Both men were silent. Steepley's left arm had on it a nasty mesquite scratch, Morant could observe. Morant finally glanced at his watch, its dial illuminated in his body's shadow. Both men's shadows were now climbing the steep incline, returning up to them.
Me? I think that we go about our affairs in a more simple manner than your BSS office. If Monsieur Tyne's betrayal were incomplete, we of Quebec would be aware.
Because of Luria.
Morant pretended to fuss with his blanket, rearranging it.
But yes, the caution? Luria would be aware.
Steeply stepped gingerly up to the edge and tossed out his cigarette stub. The wind caught the stub and it soared slightly upward from his hand, moving east. Both men were silent until the butt fell and hit the dark mountainside off below them, a tiny bloom of orange. Their silence then became contemplative. Something tight in the air between them loosened. Morant no longer felt the sun on his skull. Dusk settled about them. Steeply had found his triceps scratch and twisted the flesh of his arm to examine it, his rouged lips rounded with concern. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Tuesday, the 3rd of November, Enfield Tennis Academy. AM drills, shower, eat, class, lab, class, eat, prescriptive grammar exam, lab/class, conditioning run, PM drills, play challenge match, upper body circuits in weight room, sauna, shower, slump to locker room floor with other players.
To even realize what they're sitting there feeling is unhappiness? Or to even feel it in the first place?
1640 hours, the ComAd building's males' locker room is full of clean upperclassmen in towels after PM matches. The players' hair, wet-combed and shining with barbicide. Pemulus uses the comb's big-toothed end to get that wide furrowed look that kids from Alston favor. Hal's own hair tends to look wet-combed even when it's dry.
So, Jim Trolch says, looking around, so, what do you think?
Pemulus lowers himself to the floor by the sinks, leaning up against the cabinet where they keep all the disinfectants. He has this way of looking warily to either side of him before he says anything.
Was there like a central point to all that, Trolch?
The exam was talking about the syntax of Tolstoy's sentence, not about real unhappy families, Hal says, quietly. John Wayne, as do most Canadians, lifts one leg slightly to fart.
Like the fart was some kind of task.
Standing at his locker, waiting for his feet to get dry enough to put on socks. There is a silence. Showerheads dribble on tile. Steam hangs. Distant, ghastly sounds from tea shocked over in one of the stalls of the showers. Everyone stares into the middle distance, stunned with fatigue. Michael Pemulus, who can stand about 10 seconds of communal silence, tops, clears his throat deeply and sends a loogie up and back into the sink behind him. The plate mirrors caught part of its quivering flight. Hal sees. Hal closes his eyes.
Tired, someone exhales.
Ortho Stice and John N.R. Wayne seem less fatigued than detached.
They have the really top player's way of shutting the whole neural net down for brief periods, staring at the space they took up, hooded in silence, removed for a moment from the connectedness of all events.
Right then, Trolt says. Pop quiz. Pop test question. Most crucial difference for Leith tomorrow between your historical broadcast TV set and a cartridge-capable TP.
Disney R. Leith teaches ETA's History of Entertainment 1 and 2, as well as certain high-level esoteric optics things you needed permission of the Institute to get into. The cathode luminescent panel. No, cathode gun. No. Phosphenic screen. 2 to the screen's diagonal width in centimeter lines of resolution total.
You mean a high-def viewer in general, or a specifically TP component viewer?
No analogs, Strzok says. No snow, no faint weird like ghostly double necks to UHF images. No vertical roll when planes fly over.
Analogs versus digitals. You referring to broadcast as a network versus a TP, or network plus cable versus a TP?
Did cable TV use analogs?
What, like pre-fiber phones?
It's the digitals.
Leith has that word he uses for the shift from analogs to digitals, that word he uses about 11 times an hour.
What did pre-fiber phones use exactly?
The old tin can and string principle.
Seminal. He keeps saying it. Seminal, seminal.
The biggest advance in home communications since the phone, he says.
In home entertainment since the TV itself.
Leith might say the right capable CD for entertainment.
He's hard to pin down if you get him on entertainment qua entertainment.
The Dizzles say use your own judgment, Pemula says.
Axford took it last year. He wants an argument made. He'll skewer you if you treat it like there's an obvious answer.
Plus there's the interlaced D-digitizer instead of an antenna with a TP.
Jim Strzok says, squeezing at something behind his ear.
Graham, Yard Guard Raider, is checking his underarm for more hair. Freer and Shaw might be asleep. Stice has pulled his towel down slightly and is fingering the deep red abdominal stripe a jock's waistband leaves.
Boys, I ever become president, the first thing to go's elastic.
Frulch pretends to shuffle cards.
Next item. Next, like flashcard, huh? Define acutance. Anybody?
A measure of resolution directly proportional to the resolved ratio of a given pulse's digital code, Hal says.
The Inkster has the last word once again, says Strzok,
which invites a chorus.
The Halster. Halorama. Halation.
Halation, Raider says. A halo-shaped exposure pattern around light sources seen on chemical film at low speed.
That most angelic of distortions.
Strzok says,
we'll be like vying for the seats all around ink tomorrow.
Hal shuts his eyes. He can see the page of text right there, all highlighted, all yellowed up.
He can scan the page, rotate it, fold the corner down, and clean under his nails with it, all mentally.
Leave him alone, Pemula says. Freer opens his eyes.
Do a dictionary page for us, man. Ink?
Stice says, leave him be.
It's all only half nasty.
Hal is placid about getting his balls smacked around. They all are. He does his share of chops busting. Some of the littler kids who take their showers after the upperclassmen are hanging around, listening. Hal sits on the floor, quiescent, chin on his chest, just thinking it's nice finally to breathe and get enough air. The temperature had fallen with the sun. Marat listened to the cooler evening wind roll across the incline and desert floor. Marat could sense or feel many million floral pores begin slowly to open, hopeful of dew. The American, steeply, produced small exhalations between his teeth as he examined his scratch of the arm. Only one or two remaining tips of the digitate spikes of the radial blades of the sun found crevices between the Tortolitas peaks and probed at the roof of the sky. There were the slight and dry, locationless rustlings of small living things that wished to come out at night, emerging. The sky was violet. Everyone in the locker rooms got a towel around his waist, like a kilt. Everyone except Stice has a white ETA towel. Stice uses his own sort of trademark towels, black ones. After a silence, Stice shoots some air out through his nose. Jim Strzok picks liberally at his face and neck. There are one or two sighs. Peter Beek, and Evan Ingersoll, and Kent Blott. 12, 11, 10, are up sitting on the blonde wood benches that run in front of the locker's rows, sitting there in towels, elbows on knees, not taking part.
So was Zoltan Chikmensihai,
who's 16 but speaks very little English.
Idris Arslanian, new this year, ethnically vague, 14, all feet and teeth, is a shadowy lurking presence just outside the locker room door, poking the non-caucasoid snout in occasionally, and then withdrawing, terribly shy. Each ETA player in 18 and unders has like 4 to 6 14 and unders kids he's supposed to keep his more experienced wing over, look out for. The more the ETA administration trusts you, the younger and more generally clueless the little kids in your charge. Charles Tavis instituted the practice and calls it the Big Buddy System in the literature he sends new kids' parents. So the parents can feel their kids not getting lost in the institutional shuffle. Beek, Blott, and Arslanian are all in Hal's Big Buddy group for YDAU. He also in effect has Ingersoll, having traded Todd, Postal Waite, Postlethwaite, to Axford off the books for Ingersoll because Trevor Axford found he so despised the Ingersoll kid for some unanalyzable reason that he was struggling against a horrible compulsion to put Ingersoll's little fingers into the gap by the hinges of an open door and then very slowly close the door, and came to Hal almost in tears. Axford had. Though technically Ingersoll is still Axford's and Postlethwaite Hal's. Postlethwaite, the great lobber, has a weird young old face and little wet lips that lapse into a sucking reflex under stress. In theory, a big buddy's somewhere between an RA and a prorector. He's there to answer questions, ease bumpy transitions, show ropes, act as liaison with Tony Nwangi and Tex Watson and the other prorectors specializing in little kids, be somebody they can come to off the record,
a shoulder to climb up on a footstool and cry on.
If a 16 and under gets made a big buddy, it's kind of an honor. It means they think you're going places. When there's no tournament or travel, etc., big buddies get together with their core to sextet in small group private twice a week, in the interval between PM challenge matches and dinner, usually after saunas and showers, and a few minutes of sitting slumped around the locker room sucking air. Sometimes Hal sits with his little buddies at dinner and eats with them. Not often, however. The savvier big buddies don't get too overly close with their little buddy Ephebes. Don't let them forget about the unbridgeable gaps of experience and ability and general status that separate Ephebes from upperclassmen who've hung in and stuck it out at ETA for years and years. Gives them more to look up to. The savvy big buddy doesn't rush in or tread heavy. He holds his own ground and lets the suppliants realize when they need his help and come to him. You have to know when to tread in and take an active hand, and when to hang back and let the littler kids learn from the personal experience they'll have to learn from inevitably if they want to be able to hang. Every year, the biggest source of attrition, besides graduating 18s, is 13 to 15s who've had enough and just can't hang. This happens. The administration accepts it. Not everyone's cut out for what's required of you here. Though CT makes his administrative assistant, lateral Alice Moore,
drive the Prorector's bats trying to ferret out data on littler kids' psychic states, so we can forecast probable burnouts and attritive defections, so he'll know how many slots he and admissions will have to offer incomings for the next term. Big buddies are in a tricky position. Requested to keep the Prorectors generally informed about who among their charges seems shaky in terms of resolve, capacity for suffering and stress, physical punishment, homesickness, deep fatigue, but at the same time wanting to remain a trustworthy confidential shoulder and wing for their little buddy's most private and delicate issues. Though he too has to struggle with a strange urge to be cruel to Ingersoll, who reminds him of someone he dislikes but can't quite place, Hal, on the whole, rather likes being a big bee. He likes being there to come to, and likes delivering little unpretentious mini-lectures on tennis theory and ETA pedagogy and tradition, and getting to be kind in a way that costs him nothing. Sometimes he finds out he believes something that he doesn't even know he believed until it exits his mouth in front of five anxious, little hairless, plump, trusting, clueless faces. A twice-weekly, more like once-weekly, as things usually pan out, group interfaces with his quintet are unpleasant only after a particularly bad PM session on the courts, when he's tired and on edge, and would far rather go off by himself and do secret stuff in underground ventilated private. Jim Trolch feels at his glands. John Wayne is of the sock and a shoe, sock and a shoe school. Tard, Arthostice again sighs. He pronounces it tard.
To a man now, the upperclassmen are down slumped on the locker room's blue crush carpet, their legs straight out in front of them, toes pointing out at that distinctive